This is Thursday, the 18th of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming your way, an emotional UN envoy to Syria says humanitarian attempts to help the people of Syria have not been successful.
Not one single convoy in 1 month has reached any of the humanitarian besieged areas. Not one single convoy.
Also ahead, the story of a robbery of 4 U.S. Olympic swimmers seems to be rapidly changing. VOA's Park Brewer joins us from Rio, and Michael O'Sullivan checks in live from California, where wildfires continue to tear through the dry terrain. All on today's International Edition. A haunting photograph of a bloodied young boy injured in a devastating airstrike in the Syrian city of Aleppo has captured the attention of people around the world as it circulates through traditional and social media channels. Syrian opposition activists released the photo of a boy looking stunned and exhausted as he sat in an orange chair of an ambulance with his face covered with blood and dust. You can see that photo on our webpage at voanews.com. A physician in Aleppo, Osama Abu Al As identified the boy Thursday as 5-year-old Omran Dagnish. He confirmed the boy was taken to a hospital known as M10 Wednesday night and treated for head wounds before being discharged. The boy was injured after an airstrike on the rebel-held neighborhood of Katerji. A doctor at the hospital said that 8 people were killed in the airstrike, including 5 children. Shortly after the strike, rescue workers and journalists began pulling victims from the debris. Among the rescuers was photojournalist Mahmoud Raslan, who took the iconic photo that captured the barbarity of the war in Syria. Ruslan said the boy, his parents, and his 3 siblings were rescued from the rubble of their partially destroyed apartment building. He said none of the family members sustained major injuries, but the apartment building did collapse shortly after they were rescued. A senior UN official is calling for an immediate 48-hour pause in the fighting in Syria, so desperately needed humanitarian assistance can be delivered to the millions in Aleppo and other besieged areas who have been without aid for a month. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, abruptly suspended the regular weekly meeting of the International Syria Support Group's Humanitarian Access Task Force after 8 minutes.
I decided to use my privilege as chair to declare that there was no sense to have a humanitarian meeting today unless we got some action on the humanitarian side in Syria.
De Mistura noted the only action seen in Syria involves fighting, rockets, barrel bombing, chlorine and napalm attacks, suicide bombings, and other atrocities.
Not one single convoy in 1 month has reached any of the humanitarian besieged areas. Not one single convoy. And why? Because one thing: fighting.
The one exception is the city of Deir ez-Zor, which is surrounded by Islamic State militants. De Mistura says the World Food Program has airdropped food supplies on 100 occasions to the 200,000 inhabitants of this area.
We ask for at least a pause of 48 hours. We insist on this in order to make anything meaningful for Aleppo. But the pause should also be accompanied by humanitarian aid, and that comes with it, and evacuation of medical cases.
De Mistura says he believes the United States and Russia, the 2 co-chairs of the humanitarian task force, are committed to finding a non-military solution to the Syrian conflict. But he admits he's concerned that this process is taking too long. He says more than 1 month has passed since U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov met in St. Petersburg to work out a cessation of hostilities. Unfortunately, he says, the hoped-for reduction of violence has not materialized. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Another story we're covering for you on International Edition today comes from Rio de Janeiro. It is not about the results of Olympic competition. The U.S. Olympic Committee now confirms that 2 members of the men's swim team have been detained in Rio to answer questions about an alleged robbery. An explanation as we take you live to Rio, where VOA's Park Brewer has been following this story. Park, what's the latest you have on this?
Well, Ira, of course, this all began in the wee hours of Sunday morning. The swimming competition here ended Saturday night, and these four members, male members of the U.S. swim team, had been partying at a hospitality house, the French House, and were en route back to the village. The problem is we're getting conflicting stories, and it's really changing by the day. So this thing is, you know, here we are Thursday, and it's been going on since then as to what really is the truth. And one of the swimmers, Ryan Lochte, who's a multi-gold medalist for the United States, is the one that's not here in Rio. He's already back in the United States, and he is the one that allegedly said a gun was pointed to his head, that his wallet was taken, but the alleged robbers, who they said were dressed up as policemen, did not take a cell phone nor take credentials of the athletes. And then the story started to change. And that's what we know today, especially with apparently some video footage that was taken from a gas station, that the taxi they were riding in actually stopped at a station. They couldn't get into the restroom to use the bathroom. And then apparently, supposedly, the Americans maybe broke the door down, and the manager at the station asked them to pay for it. The story is changing all the time. And today, though, the police here in Brazil are going to talk to the media about what they had. But, yes, two of the members indeed were stopped from flying back to the United States, pulled off the plane, had their passports taken. They are out of custody now. They're represented by counsel. But in essence, we don't really know the whole truth of this. The story sounds a little bit fishy. Everybody was extremely concerned when the news of this broke on Saturday. But now that it sounds like it's not quite so serious, it looks like these swimmers they have a little egg on their face because the stories are changing, and we still don't have the truth.
And I'm sure you will be doggedly after that truth as this continues, correct?
Oh, well, we hope so. It's one of the stories that everybody's following here. There have been a lot of different things going on in these Olympics that organizers are not proud of. And, of course, you know, they don't want to have a black eye with something like this. They've tried to have security as much as they can around the city, and there have been other incidences of different situations with members of other delegations having been robbed or having things stolen. But this one seemed the most serious, especially when Lochte said a gun was pointed at his head. And now he says he doesn't say that. A gun was maybe pulled out, but even there we don't know. So I think it's going to take time till we really get the whole truth about this, and it's very sad to think that. And these guys may have been intoxicated coming from a big party, so maybe they, you know, didn't want to tell the truth or were trying to play a joke, and now, you know, they could face sanctions from the U.S. Olympic Committee.
Well, we can't let you go without the continuing story, or at least one story in about 30 seconds we have left, about what highlights the action in the Olympics today.
Well, the big action will be tonight on the track, Ira, and that is because the great Jamaican Usain Bolt will try for his second gold medal at these games. That will be in the 200 meters. He's already won the 100 meters here, and he easily qualified for the 200 meters final. In fact, in one of his heats, he slowed up, and he was looking to the side, and a Canadian was trying to speed up to pass him, and he kind of shook his finger at him. This guy is just something else. He's fun to watch. He likes to play the field and play the crowd.
And he also continues to win. That is Park Brewer with us, joining us live from Rio de Janeiro. Park, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Ira.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. Time to check social media right now. Giappi Lee is with us, and the Rio thing, the Syria thing, they all seem to be gathering all kinds of social media attention.
Absolutely,
right?
Ira. And you did mention about the five-year-old boy who got pulled out of the rubble in Aleppo, and his name is Omran Daknesh. I might be butchering his name, but it's spelled as Daknesh. And like you said, his picture is available on our website.
Yeah, just push, when you get on the website, just push Middle East, the picture will come right up.
Right. Of course, you've seen the photo of him, like, covered in dust and blood, and it's really heartbreaking, and I saw that a lot of our reporters also shared it on their own social media accounts. And the video is also available, and that's released by Aleppo Media Center. And checking out the social media reaction, some people are saying it's all because of the Obama administration's failed foreign policy. And another person is pointing out the fact that, well, on the other side of the world, we have the Olympic Games. And it's so ironic because the Games are supposed to represent peace and unity. But on the other hand, we have this massacre that's happening in Syria, and they're using hashtag human hypocrisy.
Well, people can get in touch with you. How do they do that on social media?
They can actually find me on Twitter and Facebook, both at G. Abby Lee, my full name.
G. Abby Lee, thank you so much for being with us. We'll talk to you again tomorrow, okay?
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. This is International Edition. Among the top stories today, the UN envoy for Syria expresses frustration at the continuing violence preventing the delivery of humanitarian aid to those in need of help in that country's many besieged areas. Brazilian authorities interrogate some U.S. Olympic team swimmers about their claim they were robbed. Turkish police issue nearly 200 arrest warrants and raid more than 100 places as they search for people alleged to have connections to a U.S.-based cleric who the government claims is behind an attempted coup last month. And the White House says President Obama will make his 11th and likely final presidential trip to Asia when he visits China and Laos in early September. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition, and this is VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman. Perhaps you've seen the pictures. You've probably heard the story that firefighters in the western United States state of California continue to battle wildfires that have burned more than 1,000 hectares since Tuesday. One of the fires is in a mountainous area north of the city of San Bernardino, burning brush and sending large amounts of white and black smoke into the sky. More than 1,500 firefighters are already on the ground and more on their way to help. Let's go live now to California, where VOA's Michael Sullivan is standing by. He's been covering the situation. Mike, what is the latest status against the battle against these fires?
Well, we've got six major fires burning in the state, Ira. The most serious right now is the one that you mentioned in San Bernardino County. That's about 100 kilometers east of Los Angeles in the foothill and mountain area. The problem is we've got very hot, dry conditions. The high temperatures get up to 37 or 38 degrees Celsius. It's very dry, and we've got a lot of tinder dry brush in these areas, and all it takes is a spark, a campfire that is not properly doused, and if the firefighters don't get on it very quickly, it can just spread very, very quickly. That fire is just 4% contained. It has burned more than 100 square kilometers. 82,000 people have been evacuated, small mountain communities up there, and 34,000 homes are still threatened. And as I say, at least five other major fires are burning in the state.
Now, a lot of people have been ordered to evacuate, and we understand quite a few have not. Is that correct?
Well, that's always the case. And these, even when a mandatory evacuation order is issued, people can just say no, and they can't, they can't be forced out. And I have spoken to people in previous fires who say, I wanted to stay and try to defend my property. And in most cases, if the fire gets close, they realize this is crazy. You know, the fires are so unpredictable. They create their own weather patterns with a hurricane force winds just from the heat. And if the fire comes anywhere near you, people generally hop in their cars or trucks and just get out of the area. But some people, you know, not realizing this, if they haven't experienced it before, will just defy the evacuation order.
I have family out in that area and have visited it quite often. What people sometimes don't understand if they haven't gone through it before is that when you have a fire like this and all of a sudden there's a wind gust, that fire can basically explode, can it?
That's right. And I have been to small towns that look, you know, they seem to be a couple of kilometers from the nearest wildland area. But all it takes is a gust of wind heading in a certain direction and an ember that lands on your property or on your roof, and a house can go up in flames. And it all happens in a matter of minutes. The firefighters who are out there battling these fires all the time, are sometimes surprised and caught off guard. And they sometimes have to make emergency escapes. And there have been cases, when they've been trapped. So these fires can be very unpredictable, especially in this hot, dry weather and if gusty winds come up.
Well, about 30 seconds left. What's the prognostication as far as getting these things at least a handle on them?
Well, you know, they pour in resources. They've got these airborne resources that drop water and fire retardant chemicals. And if they put enough resources in, they can usually contain a fire and let it burn out. But these fires are going to continue. Usually they continue through October, sometimes November, and they may last even longer in Southern California with this hot, dry year that we've got.
BOA's Michael Sullivan reporting from California that is seeing, I almost said unprecedented. Maybe they are unprecedented. Are they in a few seconds?
I don't think they're unprecedented, but the one in San Bernardino is very explosive, and it's an unusual fire. So it may be in some ways a new kind of thing you're dealing with.
BOA's Michael Sullivan in California. Thanks, Mike. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks, Ira.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Want to learn to drive a spacecraft? The European Space Agency is offering a special 4-day course to university students that will provide a unique overview of spacecraft operations. This ESA course will be taught without a lot of advanced mathematics or technical jargon. To apply, you must meet several qualifications, such as being a citizen of an ESA member or cooperating state. They recommend applicants have a good grasp on basic physics and can quickly develop an understanding of the various aspects of spaceflight operations. The European Space Agency says the course will be held at its Training and Learning Academy in Belgium from October 11th through 14th, 2016. Application forms can be found at the ESA website at esa.int and must be submitted by September 4th, 2016. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, ballet lovers in the U.S. state of Vermont are getting a taste of the art form in a very different way, outdoors on farms there. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the Farm to Ballet project helps audiences learn about and enjoy fresh from the field foods.
The setting is bucolic. Wide, lush fields, farm animals, a clear sky, a setting sun, and giant leaves of lettuce? This performance by the Farm to Ballet Company in Pulteney, Vermont, has dancers portraying plants, including giant lettuce leaves. The corps de ballet is dressed in green, and the dancers wave giant green and purple leaves in time to the music. Dancers dressed as tomatoes, farm animals, and farmers are helping to tell the story of the growing season. The 25 dancers range in age from 18 to 74. Some are professionals, but many of them are amateurs. Dancer Lindsay Hullman says performing in the open air, in someone's front yard or farm field, is not exactly the same as being in a theater.
You never know what kind of surface you're going to be dancing on. And so we always are surprised by, you know, you might go to PK and your foot might not be exactly where you thought it was going to be, like it is inside in a studio or on a stage. So there's always the surprises of the natural surroundings, and the every you know, space we've danced in is so different. So I think each experience is very unique. So that's a challenge. It's different from if you performed on a stage and you're very, you know, consistently performing in the same spot.
Chach Preger, the Farm to Ballet Project's artistic director, says the event aims to immerse the audience in the atmosphere of the farm.
One of the most exciting things about this event is the depth of experience that it encompasses, the food that you're eating on the farm, the beautiful farms, that venues that we use, the show. We really access all of our senses and bring them together into one experience. I think that becomes real powerful.
The Farm to Ballet troupe emerged out of a summer class the dancers took one year. They didn't want to go inside, so they practiced in a park, and they learned they actually could dance on grass. Audience member Jess Palachik says that she enjoyed the sunset performance.
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I'm fascinated by ballet in general, mostly because I can't do it myself, so to see someone else do it, and to see so many locals come together and do that, along with outside talent, I'm pretty sure, was really cool to see.
Dinner made from locally grown ingredients was offered before the show. Some audience members brought their own picnics to eat on the grass. The Farm to Ballet Project aims to raise money for agriculture while widening the audience for classical ballet. 75% of ticket sales go to the host farm or to agricultural nonprofit groups. The dancers have a total of 8 performances this summer at various farms around Vermont. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that wraps things up for us on International Edition. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to the State Department's annual International Religious Freedom Report, religiously motivated persecution continues to be perpetrated by governments and by violent extremist groups, such as Boko Haram and ISIL, also known as Daesh, around the world. The 2015 report, released last week, highlights in particular the worrisome prevalence of blasphemy and apostasy laws, which fully one quarter of the world's countries have on the books. Governments use these laws to tighten their regulatory grip on religious groups, particularly on minority religious groups and religions which are viewed as not traditional to that specific country. In his introduction to the report, Ambassador-at-Large for International Religious Freedom David Saperstein noted that the existence of these laws has been used by governments in too many cases to intimidate, repress religious minorities, and governments have too often failed to take appropriate steps to prevent societal violence sparked by accusations of blasphemy and apostasy. Ambassador Saperstein explains that even if accusations of blasphemy or apostasy turn out to be untrue, governments will often fail to act to hold the accusers accountable. The purpose of this annual report is not to lecture, but to shine a light on these problems and find ways to resolve them. The report also serves as an objective and comprehensive resource for NGOs, civil society groups, media, and foreign governments. The protection and promotion of religious freedom remains a key foreign policy priority for the United States. As daunting as the many challenges are that we face across the globe, we will not be deterred in the work that we do, said Ambassador Saperstein. This report is at once vivid testimony for the many whose plight might otherwise receive scant attention, and a document, a blueprint of what must be addressed to bring us closer to the day when religious freedom will thrive for all. Ambassador Saperstein added that U.S. government officials, including at the highest level, speak out regularly against abuses and violations of religious freedom and raise these concerns directly with governments that fail to protect religious freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.